You are listening to AfterSight. This recording is intended solely for individuals who are blind or have low vision.
Thank you for joining us for the Gazette read by Pat Middleton. This is being recorded on May 26th, 2025. Today we will be reading the following main articles. They believed in America. Air Force reservists to transfer to Space Force. Museum keeps history alive and flying. And we will be following up with miscellaneous articles. Starting at the top of the front page, there is a small inset picture of a USA hockey player on the ice holding up a trophy. Gold Rush, Team USA defeats Switzerland to win its first Ice Hockey World Championship in 92 years. Sports, C1. There's another little insert picture of a bridge in a valley by the mountains. Quintessential experience. Colossal construction milestone creates additions to Peaks to Plains Trail. Life, D1. Bonus coverage. Check out Gazette.com for our fully interactive e-edition. The Gazette, Gazette.com, two-time Pulitzer Prize winner, founded 1872, serving Colorado Springs and the Pikes Peak region. Monday, May 26, 2025, $2. Memorial Day. They believed in America when it did not believe in them. By Vince Bezek. In his 99 years on the planet, Ken Akuni had been sorted into many bins. The first was Nisei, the term for second-generation Japanese-Americans born in the United States. Akuni had lived in both the United States and Japan, and his family was divided between the two. The second bin was evacuee. That was the term given to 18-year-old Akuni, his brother Harry, and 7,000 other Japanese-Americans shipped out to the Granada Relocation Center in Colorado at the start of World War II because of worries about their loyalty. Franklin Roosevelt's Executive Order 9066 forcibly removed them from their home on the West Coast to a remote plain of sage and dust in southeastern Colorado, known simply as Amache. "I was mad, jealous, whatever you want to call it," said Ken Akuni in an oral history. "There's nothing you can do about it." But Akuni did do something about it. One day, an army recruiter came with news that the government now wanted young men from the internment camps to join the military, Akuni said. On the spot, the Akuni brothers decided that even though their country had transplanted them, incarcerated them, taken all their worldly belongings away, and treated them as subhuman, they would go fight for it and maybe even die for it. "People don't realize the period of time, but you know, I was in high school, and when the war began, all these young fellows my age were all going into service, and here we couldn't even go in," said Ken Akuni. "Not that I was gung-ho, loyal to the U.S. and everything else, but you know, if you think about the time when everybody else is serving your country and you are denied, it's hard for a young guy to take." Bakatari. The boys' decision to enlist earned them a new label, Bakatare, or fool, from the first-generation immigrants in camp. And that's when they scolded us and said, "Bakatare, you know, of all the people, how could you go?" Ken recalled. "Especially you're an American. You claim you're an American, and yet you're discriminated just like we are. You're in the same camp we are, you know. How could you take that kind of crap and still do the thing you're trying to do?" Because Ken was only 18 and still in school, Harry had to sign for him to get him enlisted. "I mean, I said, hey, this is a point that we can do something about our situation," Ken said. "I thought about the fact that why are we here? You know, is it because Japan attacked the United States and that was it? Or is it because the Nihonjins never had an opportunity to prove their loyalty to the country? I kind of felt, and I think Harry and we all talked about it, that if we didn't take this time to do something to change the way other people looked at the Niseis, or the Japanese, we'll forever be thought of as a non-American. American. Ken was trying on a new categorization of his own choosing. "It was the first time I felt like an American," he said. While some internees of Amachi embraced the opportunity to serve their country, others protested the idea of military service while they and their families were imprisoned and living under armed guard. In July 1944, 11 young men from Amachi received 10 to 18 month sentences for draft evasion, but they were the exception. A total of 953 men and women from Amachi volunteered or were drafted for military service, the highest rate of volunteerism of any of the 10 Japanese internment camps. I found Ken Okuni's oral history in the Densho Digital Depository, part of the Gail K. Yamada Collection, after visiting Amachi for the first time. Last week, during the pilgrimage, the weekend every spring, the descendants of the Amachi survivors come to the camp to remember. This year marked the 50th anniversary of the first pilgrimage in 1975, which was one of the official events commemorating the centennial of Colorado's statehood. So out here, the governor of Colorado was one of the more friendlier governors at the time in welcoming the Asian Americans to their state, said Amachi Park Ranger James McGill. Most of the other states surrounding Colorado did not want Japanese Americans in their state at all. So the governor of Colorado at the time invited them here. His support for the Japanese cost Governor Ralph Carr his political career. He lost in his run for the Senate in 1944 and never returned to politics. Over time, however, his principled stance became a point of honor. Today, the building that houses the Colorado Supreme Court is named after him. Enemy aliens. The brothers, both fluent Japanese, volunteered for the U.S. Army Military Intelligence Service in the Pacific, where they were classified into yet another bin, enemy aliens. In an environment rife with hostility, even from fellow U.S. soldiers, the brothers played a vital role in the war effort. They used their proficiency in Japanese to interrogate Japanese prisoners, provide translations, and create propaganda used to encourage opposing forces to surrender. After intensive training at Camp Savage, Minnesota, Ken was deployed to the China-Burma-India Theater. He was attached to British forces to open the Lido Road in Myatkyina, Burma. He remembers harrowing military transport flights with the Flying Tigers over the Himalaya hump into Chongqing, China. The brothers' biggest fear, though, running into one of their other brothers, those who had returned to Japan with their father from California after their mother had died in childbirth. Ken wasn't sure, but suspected two of his brothers could be fighting for the Japanese. "There was a possibility that I might run across my kid brother," Harry said in the oral history. "And I think we've talked about it with some of the other guys in the service. What would you do? I mean, if the guy points a gun, what can you do? But you'd think, well, if you had a chance, you would try to talk to them. The other part was that, mercifully, I was thinking that I would not recognize them, because there had been quite a few years since I last saw them." Go for broke. An estimated 33,000 Japanese Americans served in the U.S. Armed Forces during World War II. Amachi internees served in many units, including the storied 442nd Regimental Combat Team, as well as the Women's Army Corps and the Nurses Army Corps. The 442nd was activated in February 1943 and consisted of only Nisei recruits who had completed a loyalty survey. They trained for over a year before deploying to Italy to join up with the 100th Infantry Battalion, composed of 1,400 Nisei Hawaiian National Guardsmen serving in their own special segregated unit. On June 26, 1944, the 442nd attacked the right flank of a battalion of highly trained German troops in the town of Belvedere, their first major battle. In just a few hours, the outnumbered men of the 100th destroyed the battalion and captured the town, losing only 11 men. The 442nd went on to fight in a series of brutal engagements near Rome and then in France. They fought courageously at Cassino and the Gothic Line and rescued what became known as the Lost Battalion from Texas, suffering more than 800 casualties in order to save 211 lives. They were used like cannon fodder to fight the toughest battles, but they did so willingly, always trying to live up to their motto, "Go for broke." Kibi. Because of their competency in military intelligence, Harry and his brother inherited a new nickname, Kibi. Kibi refers to highly educated Japanese Americans who were born in the United States but spent a significant portion of their youth in Japan, often for education, before returning to the U.S. Due to their fluency in Japanese and familiarity with both Japanese and American cultures, Kibei were highly recruited for the military intelligence service during the war. The Kibei often found themselves caught between two cultures, as they were neither fully American nor fully Japanese. But the brothers believed their service helped shorten the war for the Americans. The MIS wouldn't have been the same without the Kibei, Harry said. Traitors. One day, while interrogating Japanese POWs in Kunming, Ken listened in subdued jubilation to the Emperor of Japan announce the surrender on a radio broadcast. Ken made his way to Tokyo after the surrender, and while reporting for duty at the Supreme Allied Command headquarters, he unexpectedly ran into his brother stepping out of an elevator. A miraculous, joyous reunion ensued. The brothers soon discovered their family in Kagoshima had also survived the war and made plans to reunite with them as well. But after the war, Ken and Harry Akune were met with scorn when they returned to the village where they had lived as children and where the rest of their family still lived. There they were given yet another name, traitor. There was the feeling that we were traitors, having lived in Japan, learning the language, then using it against them in the war, said Harry Akune. They found out that two of their brothers had indeed fought for Japan during the war, and now they were face to face with them, and the room was hot. We were ready to go at it, Ken Akune said. And then my dad said, wait a second, the war is over. We cooled down, and that was the end of it. A final epithet. Not long after, all four of the veterans returned to California and later fought on the same side for the U.S. in the Korean War. Ken met his bride-to-be Alice in Japan after the war, and they settled in Gardena, California to raise a family. He worked tirelessly for the Go for Broke National Education Center, beginning in 1989 to keep the memory of Japanese-American soldiers alive, contributing to the creation of the Go for Broke Monument, which was dedicated in 1999 in Los Angeles's Little Tokyo. His message during that work? We believed in America when America did not believe in us. On June 21, 2000, President Bill Clinton awarded the Medal of Honor to 20 Japanese-American World War II soldiers, the highest office in the land, finally acknowledging the valuable contribution Nisei soldiers made to American history. The 14,000 soldiers who served in the 442nd were eventually awarded 18,143 awards. The 442nd remains the most decorated unit for its size and length of combat service in the history of the U.S. military. Said Clinton at the ceremony, "Rarely has a nation been so well served by a people it had so ill-treated. They did more than defend America. In the face of painful prejudice, they helped to define America at its best." 77 years after he earned them, Ken Akune finally received his own medals in 2022. No one ever explained the delay. The medals were Army Presidential Unit Citation Ribbon, Army Good Conduct Medal and Ribbon, American Campaign Medal with Ribbon, Asiatic Pacific Campaign Medal and Ribbon, World War II Victory Medal with Ribbon, Sharpshooter Badge with Rifle Bar, Honorable Service Lapel Button, World War II. And just 5 months after receiving his medals, just short of his 100th birthday, Ken Akune passed away. At his funeral service, he was celebrated for helping redefine what it meant to be American. He was thanked by many Nisei at the ceremony, who said the way he and other soldiers had demonstrated loyalty for their country created freedom and opportunities that would not have been afforded subsequent generations without their service. They helped define what it is to be an American, Christine Sato, executive director of the Go for Broke Educational Foundation in Torrance, told the Los Angeles Times, that it's not about race or the color of your skin. It's about the manner in which you serve your country. By then, Ken Akune had shed all his other labels for a single one, hero. And there is a photograph of some barracks, quite a few barracks, on barren land. And the caption reads, a U.S. National Archives and Records Administration photo of Camp Amachi. And it's courtesy of the National Park Service. There is a photograph, two photographs, in the middle of the front page. And in one, a gentleman is playing a flute amidst some graves. And all of the graves have an American flag planted in front of them. And the second photograph is of a young child dressed in a red, white, and blue dress. She has flags in her hand and she's planting a flag in the ground. The caption reads, right, Tate Solberg plays A Closer Walk with Thee at the grave of his close friend, Master Sergeant Phil Perry, on Friday in Colorado Springs. Solberg, who was supposed to play the song at Perry's funeral but couldn't attend, was joined by Perry's widow Gladys as he placed the flag and played in his honor. The other caption is, Emmy Haynes, 5, places flags on veterans' graves at the Air Force Academy Cemetery on Friday in Colorado Springs. For over a decade, volunteers and family members have joined cemetery staff in placing flags to honor veterans on Memorial Day weekend. This year, approximately 1,650 flags were placed, and the photos are by Parker Siebold of the Gazette. Air Force Reservists to Transfer to Space Force by Mary Shin. After delays, hundreds of full-time Air Force reservists are preparing to join the Air Force, the Space Force, this year, while the plan for their part-time colleagues is still in the works. The transfers were directed by a 2024 law that is phasing out space-focused positions in the reserve, including the entire 310th Space Wing, headquartered at Schriver Space Force Base. Most of the space-focused reservists in the country work for the wing and can choose to apply for the active duty, leave the reserve, or retrain into a different reserve role. The 310th Space Wing expects about 300 reservists will follow an initial 5 who have already transferred into active duty, said Colonel Adam Fisher, wing commander. The wing only had 250 full-time members, so some part-time reservists were among those selected to go full-time, Fisher explained. Since reservists applied and were accepted into active duty, the transfer process has been delayed, Fisher said, and it could be a challenge to see the reservists separated from the Air Force and transferred into the Space Force during the traditional summer move cycle. We were supposed to have started the assignment process months ago, but delays and, we'll say, reframing of priorities from the Space Force have delayed the release of the assignments, Fisher said. Last week, he said, the group planning to transfer was expected to receive job offers from the Space Force soon, and those would include details such as their new squadron and title. Most of those roles will be focused on training, including roles in Space Training and Readiness Command, or STARCOM, based in Colorado Springs. Previously, some of those airmen worked alongside their active duty counterparts, working in missile warning or running GPS satellites. While STARCOM headquarters is slated to move to Florida, some of the positions will remain local, he said. Fisher said he expected the high level of experience among his reservists would be a good fit for training roles. Some will be classroom instructors, but others likely will move into positions such as testing new weapons and space systems, or into replicating the threats that guardians could see in the field to help guardians train. Our individuals, I believe, will be well represented in Space Force, he said. The transfer of Air Force reservists is separate from the ongoing fight over whether space-focused Air National Guard units will transfer into active duty. While a law directed some of those units to transfer this year, state governors are pushing back on the plan, in part because so many guardsmen plan to leave if they are forced to transfer. In the reserve, the 300 people transferring into full-time roles from the 310th Space Wing are leaving behind about 600 to 800 part-time reservists who are also interested in transferring but are waiting on a plan, Fisher said. It is possible that a plan could be rolled out in July and reservists could move into part-time Space Force roles next summer. Absorbing part-time roles is a brand new model for an active duty branch of the military, but it could allow the service to benefit from the expertise of civilians, General Chance Saltzman, Chief of Space Operations, said previously. Many reservists work for military contractors and bring expertise to their positions. The number of part-time reservists who apply for a transfer will depend on the model the Space Force releases, Fisher said. In the meantime, he said, the 310th Space Wing has been reorganizing ahead of the departure of a large number of full-time staff. It has collapsed from 14 operational squadrons to 4, one at each of the bases where the wing operates units, Buckley, Shriver, Peterson, and Vandenberg Space Force bases. A group of 78 full-time people will remain to help manage them, he said. What we've done is basically collapse the command structure, and we still have pockets of excellence in each of those operational missions that they can still do and will still do missions for their respective counterparts, he said. The wing has been working closely with Space Force Delta commanders to help them understand how the remaining part-time reservists can help them, Fisher said. Some of those full-time people staying behind, including Fisher, have been selected for the Space Force, but those moves will be delayed. Reservists who choose to stay rather than transfer into active duty could find jobs in the cybersecurity or intelligence fields, depending on an individual's interest, Fisher said. Air Force Reserve Command has been really great providing advocacy for retraining into other career fields for our folks, he said. Support personnel also have the option to transfer or leave. So far, about 400 people have chosen to leave the wing for other opportunities, Fisher said, including retirement, another position in the reserve, or in the civilian world. The leadership is working to ensure those who choose to stay through inactivation are taken care of, he said, and they are trusting in the leadership to support them. It's incumbent upon us to make sure we maintain that trust work to provide them opportunities, Fisher said. Museum Keeps History Living and Flying by Alexander Edwards. As Americans look back and remember the men and women who have died in service to the country, volunteers and employees at Westpac Restorations and the National Museum of World War II Aviation see them every day in the aircraft they keep alive. And the museum will soon expand to keep even more memories of veterans and warbirds, big and small, alive. Space is at a premium as Westpac, owned by Museum President and CEO Bill Clayers, restores more aircraft that find a home at the museum. The project to expand the museum has been ongoing for several years, but now the museum is close to awarding a contract for constructing the second hangar. We had 5 companies bid on it. We've eliminated 3, and we're down to the last 2. I'm thinking we'll do a grand opening in August of next year, he said. The new building is a mirror. The door will now open to the airport, so that will allow us now to have airplanes come down like B-29s and B-17s that are traveling. While more space for more airplanes is great, Clayers is also attempting to build a third building, an 86,000 square foot aviation hall that will be a facility that will bring more space for exhibits education, and can serve as a large event center. Claire's called the Aviation Hall a function of money, as it will take a significant amount of it to make the hall a reality. But for the time being, the museum is home to several unique, airworthy airplanes, setting it apart from other museums in Pueblo and Denver. Several aircraft are veterans, having flown in combat during World War II and the Vietnam War. Two aircraft, the P-38 Lightning and the AD-5 Sky Raider, were reunited with their pilots after being buried in the New Guinea mud and fleeing the fall of Saigon, respectively. The Lightning is a sleek aircraft, a rarity for twin-engine designs, and even on the ground looks fast. It was a game-changer for many pilots fighting against the Imperial Japanese military in the South Pacific, completely outperforming the previous P-39 Era Cobras and P-40 Warhawks. And its pilot, Frank Royal, just so happened to live in Colorado Springs. Royal, 101 years old at the time, promised Claire's that he'd stay alive long enough to see the aircraft fly once more. To find something like this, then bring it back and reunite the pilot and the airplane is life-changing for a person, Claire said. When we got ready to go, Frank walked over, went up the air stair door, climbed up to the front of a Cessna 421, jumped in the right seat and said, "Come on, let's go. I'm ready to go." It was incredible. The three aircraft, Royal's P-38, the Cessna, and Claire's B-25 Mitchell, took to the sky. His final mission accomplished, Royal passed away a month later. The P-38, known to museum staff as White 33, for the large white 33 painted on the nose, has possibly the most extensive combat history of any airplane at the museum. It was flown by the Army Air Force's first double ace, Captain Kenneth Sparks, who shot down two Japanese aircraft with it. The second aircraft came at Sparks head-on. The Japanese plane hit Sparks's wing, slicing through it, and crashed. Sparks returned to base, but the aircraft, severely damaged, was ultimately scrapped at Finchhafen Airfield in New Guinea. Decades later, it was pulled from the mud and saltwater-infused air and taken to Colorado Springs, where it was restored beginning in 2017. Every day I walk by it, look at it, and say, "I can't believe we restored that and reused 45% of the original parts," Claire said. "I don't want to build another P-38. It's really the most complex airplane I've ever worked on." Westpac is also in the process of restoring several aircraft. An online list includes a pair of F-6F Hellcats, the most successful Navy fighter of World War II, a P-47D, and a pair of P-40s currently in the shop. The P-40 is an oft-forgotten aircraft of World War II, though it did much to hold the line in the Pacific Theater. It was the plane that flew against Japanese attackers at Pearl Harbor and helped keep Australian skies free from the wrath of the expansionist empire. The famed Flying Tigers flew the P-40, and it was one of the aircraft used by the Tuskegee Airmen. Claire's wants to see the P-40 project pushed through so that it can be represented in the museum, but his true passion project is the P-47 Razorback. "I think that I can probably do another 6-7 years. I work every day. I don't just run the museum and run this business. I work in the shop," he said. "Let's push this P-40 through. Building a Razorback, combat war veteran, that's going to be probably a 4-year project, maybe 5. So much depends on costs, however. Fortunately, Claire said a lot of people are working on P-40s, so should a need for a part come up, he has sources. Claire's got the most excited talking about an ongoing excavation in New Guinea. He was tight-lipped on what aircraft the team may be excavating, but did let on that it would be one of only 2 in the world known to have survived World War II. In the meantime, Claire's is focusing on completing existing projects in front of him and keeping his own B-25 Mitchell ship shape. A far cry from its previous life, the plane, nicknamed In the Mood after the famous song, used to be the worst warbird on the airshow circuit. It never made it. If it did make it, it never flew because it had problems, he said. I had a whole team of guys in my shop, and we just worked on it on the weekend, and then we got it to where it was probably one of the more reliable airplanes. Claire's and his team's commitment to restoration is on full display for every guest to the museum. Westpac recently finished restoration on an SB-2C Helldiver, which should take to the Pikes Peak region skies over the course of the summer. If you're not here to educate and inspire, then you're here for the wrong reasons. That's the reason we do what we do, Claire said. And there are two photographs. In the first one, there are two people inside of an airplane, and you can see out. You can see the landscape through the windows of the aircraft. And the second picture is of an aircraft, and there is a large crowd inside of it, inside what looks like a hangar. The captions read above, museum visitors gather in a hangar at the World War II Aviation Museum for a presentation about Army Air Corps Colonel Paul Pappy Gunn next to the museum's B-25 J. Mitchell, an aircraft Gunn helped make famous in Colorado Springs on May 17th. Left, pilot Bill Clares left and his son and co-pilot Scott Clares fly the B-25J Mitchell in the mood for a crowd at the World War II Aviation Museum on May 17th. The museum hosts a monthly flight day throughout the summer. On June 21st, it will have a presentation and demonstration flight of the ultra-rare SB-2C Helldiver. Photos are by Parker Siebold of the Gazette. The weather is on B6, high of 58, low of 44. And there is an advertisement. In loving memory, obituary, and remembrance tribute feature, the next edition will publish on Sunday, July 13th. For more information, contact 719-636-0390 or advertisingresponse@gazette.com. The Gazette. Moving to local and state news. Six shot near Palm Park and Academy by Lisa Walton. And there is a photograph. It is very dark at nighttime, and you can see police lights in the picture. The picture is from Connor Fay of KOAA5, and the caption reads, a Colorado Springs Police Department cruiser blocks Potter Drive between Palmer Park Boulevard and East San Miguel Street late Saturday. Six people were injured, one critically, in a shooting late Saturday night near Palm Park and Academy Boulevards in Colorado Springs, apparently after an argument escalated, police said in an online report. The initial call for service came in around 10:12 p.m. from the Olympic Gardens Apartments in the 1400 block of Potter Drive, just south of Palmer Park Boulevard, near the Rustic Hill Shopping Center. The shooting appears to have occurred on the street in front of the apartments. Four shooting victims were found at the scene and were transported to local hospitals. Two additional victims were taken to hospitals in personal vehicles, according to police. Potter Drive was closed in both directions between Palmer Park Boulevard and East San Miguel Street during the investigation. One resident in the area said Sunday morning that he heard dozens of shots from at least one rifle and saw large shell casings on the street. Police said the investigation is ongoing. No arrests have been announced. Anyone with information about the shooting is asked to call police at 719-444-7000 or contact Pikes Peak Crime Stoppers at 719-634-STOP or 7867. Court to rule if self-defense in workplace is grounds for firing by Michael Karlick. The Colorado Supreme Court will decide whether employers may terminate workers for using self-defense in the workplace. Last week, the justices agreed to answer the question posed by a federal judge who is deciding whether a former convenience store clerk's wrongful discharge lawsuit should proceed to a jury trial. Although U.S. District Court Judge Nina Y. Wang indicated she had the power to interpret unclear legal terrain, she felt most comfortable with Colorado's highest court defining the limits of Colorado law. Moreover, the court notes that plaintiff did originally file this case in state court, and if the case had stayed there, this question may well have made its way up to the Colorado Supreme Court, she wrote in a May 9th order. But because the defendant transferred the lawsuit to federal court, there is no opportunity for the Colorado Supreme Court to answer this question, absent Wang's request. Marianne Moreno was behind the register at a Westminster Circle K store when a man holding two hunting knives asked if she could give him cigarettes for free. In Moreno's telling of the October 2020 encounter, the robber attacked her while she was trapped behind the counter, prompting her to defend herself. In the process, she made contact with her assailant. After reviewing the security footage, Circle K managers did not believe Moreno acted in self-defense. Instead, she stepped toward the shoplifter and briefly grabbed his arm and shirt as he reached for the merchandise. Those actions violated the company's don't chase or confront policy for shoplifters, and Circle K terminated her employment. Moreno filed suit against her former employer, alleging it terminated her in violation of Colorado's public policy, namely the law's recognition of a right to self-defense. Initially, Wang sided with Circle K, finding Colorado law did not support the idea that an at-will employee may not be fired for exercising self-defense in the workplace. However, a three-judge panel for the U.S. Court of Appeals for the 10th Circuit believed Wang had looked at the case backward. Instead of having a federal judge interpret an unclear area of state law implicating the rights of workers, explained Judge Gregory A. Phillips, it would have made more sense for Wang to first answer whether the evidence showed Moreno, in fact, was using self-defense at all, then whether Circle K fired her because of it. Though within its power, the district court fielded an uncertain state law question without addressing two fact-based arguments that may have obviated the need for federal predictions about the meaning of state law, Phillips wrote in the panel's December 31st order. The panel directed Wang to evaluate whether the evidence conflicted to the point where a jury trial would be necessary to decide Moreno's claim. After the case returned to Wang in January, Moreno asked her to invite the Colorado Supreme Court to answer the question of whether state policy permits employers to fire workers for using self-defense, using a process known as certification. The question to be certified impacts thousands of workers across the state of Colorado who, like Ms. Moreno, may find themselves the victim of an armed robbery at any point in time, wrote her attorneys. Circle K downplayed the importance of the question, arguing it was undisputed that Moreno was not acting in self-defense. Moreover, the managers who fired her did not believe her conduct amounted to self-defense. But Wang was not so sure. When the parties present different versions of events and support their positions with conflicting evidence, it is up to the jury, not the court, to review the evidence and draw conclusions, she wrote, adding that jurors could find Moreno was using self-defense. Further, Wang did not place significant weight on the fact that Moreno's managers did not fire her for acting in self-defense. If Circle K's don't chase or confront policy prohibits employees from acting in self-defense, and an employee is fired for violating that policy, then it is possible they were fired for using self-defense. For a more straightforward analogy, suppose an employer had a workplace policy prohibiting its employees from serving on a jury and terminated an employee for attending her court-ordered jury service, Wang explained. The employer surely would not be permitted to avoid liability on the employee's subsequent wrongful termination claim by simply stating that the employee was terminated for violating a workplace policy. Therefore, she concluded the possibility of bringing the case to a jury trial hinged on the question she already attempted to answer. Does Colorado law prohibit employers from firing someone for using self-defense in the workplace? If it does, Moreno's claims would go to trial. If it does not, Circle K likely prevails. 3 days after Wang invited the Colorado Supreme Court to weigh in, the justices agreed to take the case. The case is Moreno v. Circle K Stores, Incorporated. From the editorial page, Live Free or Die While Honoring Our Dead, the Gazette's viewpoint. There is a picture of some cadets that are saluting, and there is a plaque in the forefront that says, The Mountain Post Global War on Terrorism. The caption reads, The Mountain Post Warrior Memorial Ceremony honored 407 fallen heroes at Fort Carson in May 2024. The photo is courtesy of Parker Siebold of the Gazette. Memorial Day is a solemn tribute to Americans who died in military service, including thousands of Coloradans lost in World War II, Korea, Vietnam, Iraq, and Afghanistan. Their gravestones stand for the lifestyles we often enjoy as if freedom came free. Memories of our fallen underpin the exceptional quality of life Coloradans cherish, despite challenges posed by modern state politicians working to jeopardize cultural and economic liberty. This holiday, as we honor bygone heroes, we should acknowledge our responsibility to preserve the freedom they paid for. What we enjoy in relative peace was never by default and will never be free. Live free or die is more than a phrase on New Hampshire license plates. Those we mourn lived by the words of Patrick Henry, who wisely implored, "Give me liberty or give me death." Colorado's quality of life is unparalleled, despite a near decade-long leadership crisis. Our 300-plus days of sunshine facilitate world-class recreation, hiking the Rockies, skiing the slopes, rafting the Arkansas, and too much more to list. Colorado's splendor draws visits and attention from millions around the globe who envy the freedom and opportunities we too often take for granted. Despite concerning new indicators, Colorado's economy has flourished for generations. A tech and aerospace boom holds great promise for our future if we prevent regulatory excess from choking the freedom that fuels innovation, investment, and production. Vibrant community Memorial Day celebrations from Fort Collins to Trinidad to Lyman to Grand Junction attest to our state's resilience and pride. We demand to live free despite recent impositions to excessive market regulation, soaring taxes, burdensome fees, inflation, and special interest cultural and educational mandates. The heroes we honor died for our individual liberty, not top-down edicts that divide humanity into identity groups, deemed from on high as the oppressors and oppressed. It is a safe bet the fallen would want us to unite around common decency and constructive goals, not to fight over first world concerns born of the very comfort, safety, and wealth for which they sacrificed. Let's not let Memorial Day become another 3-day weekend defined mostly by beer, bratwurst, and a day off from work. However we celebrate liberty, we should do so with solemnity, joy, gratitude, and a commitment to defend what men and women died for when freedom and autonomy were threatened by tyrants. As we honor the dead, we convey thanks and encouragement to more than 32,000 active duty military personnel who live and work in Colorado, ready at a moment's notice to risk their lives to preserve what we have. By honoring the dead, we tacitly acknowledge and respect more than 332,000 Colorado veterans who defended us at a risk to their lives. While we camp, grill, visit graves, and attend festivities, we must take time to remember how the fallen made our lives possible in the country's most beautiful state. Their legacies obligate us to defend our freedoms in all human events. Remember them, pray for them, and thank them as we approach a summer of community, unity, joy, and the freedom they paid for with their lives. From World and national news. There is a picture. It's at night. It's very dark. And there are some apartment buildings, some with lights on, some without lights on. And there is an explosion in the back of the apartment buildings. The caption reads, "An explosion of drone strikes lights up Kyiv on Sunday." And the article is, "Russia launches the war's largest air attack on Ukraine," from Reuters. Russian forces launched a barrage of 367 drones and missiles at Ukrainian cities overnight, including the capital Kyiv, in the largest aerial attack of the war so far, killing at least 12 people and injuring dozens more, officials said. The dead included three children in the northern region of Zhytomyr, local officials there said. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky called on the United States, which has taken a softer public line on Russia and its leader, Vladimir Putin, since President Donald Trump took office, to speak out. "The silence of America, the silence of others in the world, only encourages Putin," he wrote on Telegram. "Every such terrorist Russian strike is reason enough for new sanctions against Russia." It was the largest attack of the war in terms of weapons fired, although other strikes have killed more people. Interior Minister Ihor Kimenko said 12 people had been killed and 60 more wounded. Earlier death tolls given separately by regional authorities and rescuers had put the number of dead at 13. "This was a combined, ruthless strike aimed at civilians. The enemy once again showed that its goal is fear and death," he wrote on Telegram. The assault comes as Ukraine and Russia prepare to conduct the third and final day of a prisoner swap in which both sides will exchange a total of 1,000 people each. U.S. Special Envoy to Ukraine Keith Kellogg said on Sunday the attack was a clear violation of the 1977 Geneva peace protocols and called for an immediate ceasefire. "Ukraine and its European allies have sought to push Moscow into signing a 30-day ceasefire as a first step to negotiating an end to the three-year war. Their efforts suffered a blow earlier this week when Trump declined to place further sanctions on Moscow for not agreeing to an immediate pause in fighting, as Kyiv had wanted. Ukraine's Air Force said Russia had launched 289 drones and 69 missiles in its overnight assault, although it said it was able to down 266 drones and 45 missiles. Damage extended to a string of regional centers, including Ukraine's second-largest city, Kharkiv, as well as Mykolaiv in the south and Ternopil in the west. In Kyiv, Timur Tkachenko, head of the city's military administration, said 11 people were injured in drone strikes. No deaths were reported in the capital, although four were killed in the region around the city, according to officials. This was the second large aerial attack in 2 days. On Friday evening, Russia launched dozens of drones and ballistic missiles at Kyiv in waves that continued through the night. In northeastern Ukraine, Kharkiv Mayor Ihor Terekhov said early on Sunday that drones hit three city districts and injured three people. Blasts shattered windows in high-rise apartment blocks. Drone strikes killed a 77-year-old man and injured five people in the southern city of Mykolaiv, the regional governor said. He published a picture of a residential apartment block with a large hole from an explosion and rubble scattered over the ground. In the western region of Kamilsky, far away from the front lines of fighting, four people were killed and five others wounded, according to the governor. "Without pressure, nothing will change, and Russia and its allies will only build up forces for such murders in Western countries," the Ukrainian president's chief of staff, Andriy Yermak, wrote on Telegram. "Moscow will fight as long as it has the ability to produce weapons." Russia's defense ministry reported that its air defense units had intercepted or destroyed 95 Ukrainian drones over a four-hour period. The mayor of Moscow, Sergei Sobyanin, said 12 Ukrainian drones had been intercepted on their way to the capital. From the Briefly section, Five skiers found dead on Swiss mountain. Five skiers have been found dead on a Swiss mountain close to the luxury ski resort of Zermatt after emergency services were alerted to some abandoned skis at 13,000 feet, the prosecutor's office in Canton Valais said on Sunday. Skiers notified the authorities on Saturday afternoon about the skis found on the slopes of the Rimpfischhorn Mountain east of Zermatt and south of the village of Sassby. Rescue workers found the bodies near the Alder Glacier after air and ground searches in the area in southwest Switzerland near the border with Italy, the prosecutor's office said. Local airline Air Zermatt said that three of the bodies were found on the debris of an avalanche below where the skis were spotted. The other two were discovered higher up the mountain, it added. Father in Gaza remains in intensive care after all nine of his children killed. The father of nine children killed in an Israeli military strike in Gaza over the weekend remains in intensive care, said a doctor on Sunday at the hospital treating him. Hamdi al-Najjar, himself a doctor, was at home in Khan Yunis with his 10 children when an Israeli airstrike occurred, killing all but one of them. He was rushed to the nearby Nasser Hospital in southern Gaza, where he is being treated for his injuries. Abdul Aziz Al-Farah, a thoracic surgeon, said Najjar had undergone two operations to stop bleeding in his abdomen and chest, and that he sustained other wounds, including to his head. May God heal him and help him, Farah said, speaking by the bedside of an intubated and heavily bandaged Najjar. Crypto investor charged with kidnapping, torture of man in New York. A cryptocurrency investor has been arrested and charged with kidnapping a man and keeping him locked up for weeks in an upscale Manhattan apartment, where authorities say he was beaten, shocked, and led to believe that his family was in danger if he didn't give up his Bitcoin password. John Woltz, 37, was arrested Friday night after the victim escaped from the 8-bedroom townhouse and flagged down a traffic officer on the street for help, according to prosecutors. Woltz was arraigned Saturday on charges of kidnapping, assault, unlawful imprisonment, and criminal possession of a firearm, court records show. He was ordered held without bail, a spokesperson for the Manhattan District Attorney's Office confirmed. His lawyer, Wayne Gosnell, said in an email that he had no comments. And those three articles were from news services. There are no obituaries listed in today's paper. Thank you for joining us for the Gazette.
AfterSight presents your low vision resource of the day. Today we want to highlight one of our favorite resources, the Colorado Talking Book Library. This organization is similar to AfterSight, but instead of newspapers and magazines, provides recorded books from a national collection that includes bestsellers, classics, mysteries, westerns, poetry, biographies, informational works, religious literature, children's books, and foreign language materials. Learn more by visiting www.myctbl.cde.state.co.us or calling 303-727-9277 or emailing ctbl.info@cde.state.co.us.
If you enjoyed this program, please register for our free services at www.aftersight.org or by calling 303-786-7777.
The content featured in this recording may not reflect the views of AfterSight or the presenter. For questions, concerns, or editorial feedback regarding the Colorado Springs Gazette, please contact them directly at 1-866-632-6397.
You're listening to AfterSight.